This is Anthony Pascal.
And this is Laurie Elster, and this is the All Access Star Trek podcast. Today we are going to review Star Trek Discovery, Episode 505, Mirrors. We're going to start with some news, although we don't have a lot of it, but we have a little, including an update on the production status of Star Trek Strange New Worlds.
Season 3 is, it's not done, but they just started on Episode 9. And the prep work for the finale has already started. So they're going to be done in a month on the season.
That feels fast. But of course, I'm not the one there doing all the work. So that's probably why it feels fast to me.
It's essentially, you know, the roughly 2 weeks per episode. They took a few weeks off for Christmas. It adds up when you kind of look at the schedule.
Yep.
So one of the directors, Jordan Canning, she directed episode 8, which wrapped up earlier this week. She posted a fun just a picture of herself with Ethan and Rebecca. No spoilers, really. She just made a joke about how she was wearing a red shirt. The 9th episode shooting now is being directed by someone, a co-producer on the show and an editor who's getting a chance to direct his episode, named Andrew Coots, who...
Is he related to Emily Coots?
You know...
I mean, it's not a super rare name, but...
Yeah, and she's also, like, done some of her own filmmaking. Yeah, It's possible.
I like that they let people... Like, that people... Star Trek has often been a place where people get a chance to direct for the first time, and editors are uniquely qualified, I think, to direct. So that's great.
And, we saw Mike do that a lot with the latest season of Lower Decks. A lot of... storyboard guys have kind of moved into directing, and so people are moving up the chain. Yeah, and in fact, later we're gonna have some audio from Carlos Sisko. He's a guy who started at the bottom and has moved his way up and is now writing scripts, which is another Star Trek tradition
and a great one.
The most famous one, of course, being Brandon Braga himself, who's written more episodes than anyone.
Yep,
started as a PA. As did Terry Metallus. Terry Metallus, yeah. You know, so.
Yep.
But they did bring in a ringer for the season finale, Maha Vervillo. She directed the series premiere, which is you know, doing the pilot is super important. You pick your best people for that. And she did the season 2 finale, and she's doing the season 3 finale. And she posted a picture of, like, the sign on her door. So she's already started.
Yeah, and we rounded up a whole bunch of fun social media posts from everybody, including something cute that Anson posted saying that season 3 will require cosplayers to bring their A-game, and just other cute stuff. So it's worth having a look if you're a fan of the show.
You know, the rest are little updates. The Shatner documentary, which we dedicated a podcast to a month ago, is coming to video on demand everywhere on Friday. Basically, if you're hearing this podcast, it's out.
So go watch it. I mean, don't stop the podcast. First finish the podcast, then go watch it.
And then, re-listen to our old podcast if you haven't, seen it before.
Even if you have. Wouldn't it be fun to just hear it again?
Sure. I have seen some people, as we talked about on the pod, this is not a normal documentary, which is no surprise. It's widely acclaimed. I liked it. You liked it. Brian liked it. But it's not like a History Channel's typical.
It's not a biography. It is a very Shatner-esque. If you read his books, his current books, you'll have a good sense of what to expect, sort of flow-wise and tonally.
It's worth the ride.
And there are great clips in it. So that a more concrete side of it.
Yeah, it's really well done. It's not just Shatner sitting there saying crazy stuff. There's plenty of that, of course. it's the rare clips and all that kind of stuff is great.
Good stuff. We also want to remind everybody, especially for those who have not yet listened to our podcast bonus episode, our supplemental podcast episode with Armin Shimerman, Kitty Swink, Jonathan Frakes, and Juan Carlos Cotto, talking about the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network and then the Purple Stride Walk, which is happening this weekend on Saturday. So they've been asking everybody to, if you can walk, walk, if you can donate, donate, and if you can't, please just spread the word. And if you want to support them, you can go to purplestride.org/teamtrek.
if you haven't listened to it, it's a fun podcast discussion, really positive, talking about the work that PanCan does. And then we have a freewheeling discussion about Star Trek and writers and all sorts of stuff.
And lots of very loud laughter and general overlapping chaos.
Yeah.
I thought it was fun.
Let's switch to Discovery.
Well, we'll start with a book that's we've got a preview for a new book that's coming out in September. And it's called, what is the full title?
It's called Star Trek, The Art of Glenn Hetrick's Alchemy Studios. Glenn Hetrick is the Emmy-winning prosthetic makeup artist for Star Trek Discovery on all five seasons. And it's a book about his work and, you know, and his studio, Alchemy Studios. All the work that they've done for Discovery over five seasons. It's written by the same guy who did pretty much the same book for Star Trek Beyond, all about, you know, the makeup art for that, which I think didn't that get nominated for an Oscar? It was really good.
Yeah, I think so. The makeup on Beyond was extraordinary. The aliens that they put in were amazing. Yeah. And so, yeah, like this is, you know, Glenn's done work on Saurians, Kelpians, Vulcans, Romulans, right? Like so many races that we've seen, alien races. Really talented, brilliant guy.
I'm looking forward to seeing what he has to say about the Klingons, too. You know,
I know.
I know, because I've spoken to him about it. I mean, I remember he was pretty frank about the, you know, what happened with the whole thing in season two. So hopefully the book is honest about that. But it's mostly pictures and behind the scenes stuff. So it looks pretty cool. And that comes out in September. So before we start talking about this week's episode, there's a theory article up on the site written by Ian Robertson. It delves into the time travel episode where they briefly dip into the future, and it takes a look at that scene and says, you know, what does this mean for Calypso? And there's various theories on
just reminding people of what Calypso is. It was one of the short treks, and it was written by Sean Cochran and Michael Chabon, who wrote it together, I believe. I thought a very artistic, beautiful little short trek, a really interesting little short film. But it was Zora in the far future, Discovery crew long dead, Discovery abandoned.
I mean, it was Zora before Zora was Zora.
Right.
Because introduced Zora.
For the first time.
Yeah, Zora didn't. We then saw Zora emerge in season three. So they showed us half the salute, you know, the connection of Zora, but we don't know how the Discovery ended up abandoned in that far future. And we think, I mean, there must be a connection because Sean Cochran, who co-wrote it with Michael Chabon back in 2018, you know, wrote the episode. So
right,
it was overt. He was making a connection. We just don't know what his connection was. The theory we kind of like is that Calypso was a dream because he introduced dreams into last week's episode.
Right. She says, is this a dream or am I dreaming again or something like that?
Because there's inconsistencies with Calypso and Discovery because they jumped in the future and they changed the ship and yada, yada, yada. This kind of covers all of that. It's a dream. She's an unreliable narrator. And, you know, because Calypso is really a retelling of a Greek myth. I mean, let's not get too persnickety about canon and, you know, when did they leave the ship and why? And I kind of just like that it's this dream. So anyway, interesting. Yeah,
that's my favorite theory as well, for sure.
So we've already recorded our review of this week's episode, Mirrors, episode 5, which we're going to play in a moment. But before we do, there's a couple things that come up in our review that I think we're going to sort of answer now because I had a chance to talk to one of the co-writers of this episode, Carlos Cisco. And you know, one of the big things that we're going to get into is, you know, this episode takes the mask or the helmet off the Breen and we get to see their two faces. And Lori and I, when we get into it later, we were kind of trying to sort out what was going on there.
And he very nicely and thoroughly explained it to you. So here we go.
You know, their natural form is that sort of ooey gooey jelly Breen form. And they had in that time evolved a way to protect themselves, which was hardening their outer shell into, you know, basically skin. And that unfortunately for them, took an immense amount of concentration. So it made them and energy. So it made them like slower, more sluggish, less intelligent, basically. And over time, they compensated for that, creating the refrigeration suits that we, you know, have come to see them in. And then sort of culturally, it became an anathema for them to display that face, that solid face, especially to outsiders, because it was essentially a sign of weakness. It was, you know, this thing that they had to do to compensate for the fact that they were like very soft and you know, would die easily. And so, you know, in the sort of the way that the, you know, kind of like building on the architecture of the Breen from DS9 and, you know, what came from that, that we had talked about the Breen being kind of a extreme meritocracy where you are judged entirely by your actions. The suit is there both to protect you and erase any sort of unique signifiers about who you are. And so Locke walking around unmasked is sort of in direct defiance of that, cultural more, that they have established.
I mean, that all kind of makes sense. It's a little confusing maybe, but I think I get it. And it's interesting for sure. Like, obviously they put a lot of thought into it, which I like. That's usually all I want, is for someone to have thought it through. But it's full of interesting ideas.
Carlos is an interesting guy. So he's a nerdy guy who's into a lot of fandom, but he strangely didn't follow Star Trek. He's a young guy, and in the 90s, his family didn't have a TV. I don't know. I don't understand. But he
does not compute.
So when he started on Discovery, he's like, I don't know Star Trek. So he immediately started watching Star Trek, and by the end of his first year, which was season 3, he had pretty much watched everything.
That is astonishing to me.
3 episodes a day. He was just pounding Star Trek for
and
years.
And I guess not getting to watch anything else.
What's interesting is for seasons 4 and 5, where he wrote episodes, he was kind of one of the Trek experts in the room because he had just watched all of it. So it was like fresh in his mind.
Right. It's not even like us where we can forget things because, last time I saw that was, you know, 15 years ago.
And he told me like DS9 was his favorite, you know, is now one of his favorite shows. And he even rewatches it again. So you can see why he was excited to be paying off the mystery of the Breen, which was such a big DS9 mystery.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good for him.
So the other thing that he talked about that we had also brought up in our review was just, and we've been talking about this a lot, I think, is the way we're seeing more canon and more legacy Star Trek information, like species and storylines in Discovery. So more so this season than we've really seen before. And he talked about that too.
You know, both the studio and Secret Hideout, Alex and Michelle all wanted this season to sort of connect Discovery back to the greater body of Trek a little more. And that didn't mean that we had to like really like dig into canon and stuff, but there was, I think, a greater desire to see what we are familiar with from the past in the 32nd century and what it looks like and how it's different or how it's not different and why. You know, obviously this is a season that has a focus on an episode taking place in the 24th century, right? So naturally, because of that, because every episode, or at least every episode focused on the clue is going to be focused on the whims of a 24th century scientist, that is naturally going to have more connections back to, you know, what people would consider classic Trek.
I mean, the most interesting thing I think he said was that this is a top-down decision.
Mm-hmm.
You and I know what things were like way back when they started with Discovery in 2017. You know, this was not the attitude from the studio.
I got stories of things that just – they were – I'm just going to say it because I was working on After Trek back then, and they were freaked out by too much canon and freaked out by too many connections and worried about – I think they were worried. I never was that clear on what the worry was, but it was definitely – you know, yes, they immediately started with Spock's sister and they had Sarek and all of that. But there were definitely things they wanted to stay away from. And now I feel like they're embracing it. And I think they're doing a very nice job with it.
I still see this season as almost a parallel of Enterprise, which, as we can all remember, was not called Star Trek Enterprise when it was launched in 2001.
Don't call it Star Trek.
Yeah.
That was a good choice.
And slowly but surely, by season four, they're like, you know what? The sweet spot for this show are mini arcs and connections to canon, and which mostly worked, and like Discovery.
This will be the end of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
I know. I really feel like the show's doing such a good job this season that it's just kind of breaking my heart that it's ending. But maybe, you know, go out on a good note, right?
Yeah. And Alex, and I think maybe someone else from Discovery is in the Academy writers' room. So hopefully these lessons are learned and to other Star Trek projects in development that they are, you know, that 2017 attitude that they have is dead, and they now know what the right balance of is. Good for them, hopefully.
I honestly think that something that's helped the new series and the old series really connect is the magic of Jonathan Frakes. Like, once he started being part of Discovery, people started warming up to the idea.
Yeah, I remember getting that press release. It was like season one of Discovery where they, you know, they had the picture of Frakes, and it was kind of this big deal of the return of Jonathan Frakes, and it was in Entertainment Weekly. And I think ever since, like, they noticed that, like, oh, wait a minute,
there's goodwill to be had, is what they realized. And of course, he shows up on set and everybody falls in love with him because he's delightful. Yeah.
Yeah, it may have been the turning point. All right, it's time to talk Mirrors, halfway point to episode
505.
You know, it isn't what we thought it was going to be. They kind of tricked us with the trailers.
They did.
And the title of the episode.
And the title.
I mean, it's mirror adjacent, let's just say.
No, it's a very good title for what was actually going on in the episode.
Right. I mean, that title's doing a lot of work in one word.
It's tricking us, and yet it's also fulfilling its promise.
This is it's very character-based. This is a book episode, I would say, if you were going to single out a single character, or a Michael and Book episode.
Or a Locke episode.
Right. Well, but that's the thing. They're using Maul and Locke as a mirror, literally. They're holding them up to each other. And their relationships, you know, I mean, obviously the characters of Maul and Locke were created as these kind of reflections of Michael and Book, I think.
Yes.
Almost a what if scenario. And that kind of plays out in this episode as well.
And that also plays into the original idea of the mirror universe, even though we don't go there.
Right.
Which was to be a reflection of sort of who we are and paths not taken. And all of that. And, of course, the theme of the episode, which they said out loud many times, just in case anybody missed it, as they like to do, was choice.
Yes, you always have a choice. But Book said at one point, maybe we're not so different. That, you know, so they made that very clear. So, you know, high level, I liked it. I have a few nitpicks and a few quibbles. But in general, I liked it, not for the visit to the mirror universe, which can be fun because it really wasn't that, you know, and the visit to the ISS, which we can get into, kind of wasn't as rewarding as you might want it to be. But I applaud the fact that they are like other episodes where they try to address an issue with the show. One of the issues with the show is the villains suck, right? In general.
Yes, they've been very mustache twirling and unnuanced.
And they're really trying to, and I think doing a good job of helping us understand the motivations and the backstories. And we're only halfway through the season of Maul and Locke. And of course, you know, we'll get into it, but, you know, they're also taking the opportunity to build on Star Trek canon by bringing back a mystery from DS9, the Breen, and saying, okay, you wanted to know what's up with the Breen? Now we're going to tell you.
Right.
So I think that's to be applauded as well. You know, so what's your high level?
I very much enjoyed the backstory of Mall and Locke. I thought that was well done, but I felt like for me, it was less interesting. It was less fun to watch for a couple of, when, you know, I'm bored by fight scenes and there were too many fight scenes and I got bored. I feel like, and we'll really dig into this, a lot of wasted opportunities, like setting something up and then not following through, a little too much tell, don't show, instead of show, don't tell. And here's a weird thing that I found, and I found the camera work, the directing, to be intrusive. Like, I found it, sometimes it was hard for me to understand where everybody was in the space because the directing, it wasn't clear. And there were like glowing lights behind people and lens flares and things, even during conversations, to the point that I got distracted and the motion was too much for me. And I went back and looked at some previous episodes to see if I just hadn't noticed that before. And no, this one has like more motion and more sort of obstruction. And I think there are scenes I would have enjoyed more if I'd had a better sense of where everybody was in the room and what was happening.
Yeah, this had a flashing lights warning. This is a bottle episode, and I think they're trying to make up for that by more frenetic lighting and camera work.
Yeah. It got in the way.
Yeah.
Too much. Yeah. I get it. Like, I understand that they always want to do something when people are talking, but I went back and looked at some earlier episodes just to, like, at those quieter scenes, and the movement, it was just less. And it wasn't all of a sudden you're seeing the light that's behind them shining in your face. So it was just done differently, and for me, got in the way. But that said, like, I think Michael and Book have such good chemistry that I love all their scenes together, and they are trying to tell the story. And I think last week when you said, you know, is this a pivot point for Michael with Book? I thought it wasn't, but now I've changed my mind and you were right. So I think last week was, in fact, the pivot point and the door is slowly opening up again. So that stuff I liked. But sickbay, I have a lot of specific things I found confusing. And the sickbay stuff, I just couldn't. There were so many times that I'm like, what's going on? I don't understand.
Yeah, there are moments that go by quickly that if you don't catch them, things later on will not make sense.
One in particular that I missed on the first couple of viewings. I usually watch it three times before we talk about it. And I didn't see it till the third viewing. And then I went, oh, that explains. I'm going to erase all my notes about what the hell is going on here, because now I understand.
Right. When they get on the ship and they scan the ship, and first you have to, like, they first explain why their regular technology isn't working, because they're in this what did they call it?
Weird.
It's like a pocket universe. Yeah. It's not a pocket universe.
Interdimensional pocket.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of it's a new spatial anomaly. You know, congratulations, they found another, you know, because how many different spatial anomalies have there been in Star Trek?
And this one, you couldn't even see it unless you adjusted your.
Right. It was an interdimensional pocket. There have been interdimensional rifts. And there was a wormhole. So, you know, it's kind of a mashup.
Sure.
Because it had been established before that you could track people from different universes. They have a different signature. And so when she got on the bridge of the Enterprise, she said, oh, you know, I there's two of them, or there's three of them in sickbay, one of which must be the clue.
Right. The quantum signatures, which was a big plot point in season one, quantum signatures and universes.
And so when they go to the trace, she found that locket. And if you don't pay enough attention, you'll notice she takes a piece of her badge and puts it in the locket.
Which I missed. It's so quick. It's quick and subtle and smart. And I totally missed it. So that later when she was like, but there's this locket, I'm like, oh God, what's the deal with the locket? And then later I'm like, what happened with the lock? I don't understand the locket. But as soon as you know that she did that, then you go, oh, she's actually been learning, which they make a point of that at the end of the episode. They have a specific conversation about how they're learning things from each clue and each adventure. And what she learned was the art of the decoy. And so she learned from the previous two episodes ago, I think it was, or three, that you can do a little bait and switch and a little trick and a little look over here and don't look over there. And she tricked them into thinking that she had something they needed.
I think the one reason why it could be quite distracting is that scene is a big exposition dump on the Mirror Universe, because we didn't visit the Mirror Universe, but that scene was trying to explain what's going on. Why is this ship here? Because they're talking about someone who was like the Chancellor. It was obviously Spock who took over the Mirror Universe and was killed, which that was established in DS9. The weird thing about the dedication plaque is it's not the original. It must be a replacement one from after he took over, possibly after he even died, because it tells the story of when Saru got the ship, picking up on Mir Saru's storyline from season 3.
Right.
You know, so it's complicated. They were picking up on TOS canon, DS9 canon, Discovery canon, adding some new canon to it. And so for those of us who like to pay attention to all that stuff, we're kind of caring about what book is talking about, because he's literally reading us this story instead of show. You know, we don't get to see
instead of a nice log entry from one of the characters that would have been really great to see. Like, and they had a lot of choices for who they could have picked. They could have filmed it. It would have made it so much better than him just talking.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the whole thing. You're on that ship, and the whole time you're on that ship, you're thinking, oh, crossover opportunity. They're going to find a recording, a log entry of someone. I really wanted to see Ethan Peck with the beard.
Yes! Right? I mean, that would be the most obvious one, but if you can't do that for whatever reason, you've got it could be anybody from Strange New Worlds.
Even if they didn't do that, they should have found a recording of the scientist, this Dr. Cho.
Right. It could have been someone we didn't. It could have been someone we've never seen. It could have been someone we have seen leaving a log somewhere for, you know, it could have been Saru. It could have been anybody. And it was, sadly, nobody.
Yeah. So this Dr. Cho, because again, this is Michael telling us at the end,
right.
She was from the Mirror Universe and was one of the five scientists. Remember, I was saying in the Janal episode, we're going to learn, you know, I thought we'd be meeting because we've met two of them, right? The Romulan and Janal. And so I thought we'd be meeting more. And this Dr. Cho left this clue here.
The invisible Dr. Cho.
Yeah. So became an admiral. Joined Janal and then went dark, which means, you know, because they erased her from the history. And again, like that would have been a lot easier if there was just like they had with the Dr. Velik, have a recording of Dr. Cho,
right?
Explaining why she left the thing in the pocket dimension.
And I would also like just to tie in that to like the whole leaving a log idea, like that. It would make sense for her to have left some log, like maybe as she's leaving the Enterprise or whatever. But instead, so they don't leave logs, but Book does a log. And I was like, why is Book doing a log? Like, it just seemed so random. His log seemed very random because who's it for and what's the point? And then she's, besides for us to see his inner life.
You know, that being said, we could commend them instead of Maul and Locke telling us their backstory, we actually got to see it.
Yeah.
So they did do quite a lot. In fact, they didn't do any tell. Like anytime someone asked them a question, like, why do you care so much? They just showed us. And that was great. I loved all the Breen stuff.
Their stuff was great. And I felt like not only do we understand their relationship and their motivation in a way that we didn't before, I think you see the potential that at some point, when they come around, because they're not horrible people and they might at some point come around, the Breen are going to be after them. Like we're going to have some kind of additional conflict coming from the Breen who are also mad at them.
Yeah.
So that was a good setup and their story was great, I thought.
And there's a ton of Breen lore.
Yeah. You were joking like the Memory Alpha team is going to be very busy after this episode.
Well, first of all, I'm kicking myself for not figuring this out because we talked before about Locke taking off his helmet in the first episode and how it was all weird and how they kept on dropping hints about the Breen. How did we not put those pieces together? He was Breen, obviously. All the clues were there, basically. And we suck for not figuring it out. But
also, by the way, if you're not following him on Twitter, you should be because This is for our listeners, because he posts great pictures. He's a huge Star Trek fan for years. He's the real deal, and he's very funny, and he's great to check in on.
The big thing about the Breen, because the Breen were always mysterious. There was a weird thing Wayoon said about how, you know, actually they're, you know, their planet's quite pleasant, apparently, you know, like they wear these suits for some other reason. But the thing about them is they have two faces. One is their evolved face, and one is their, I guess, unevolved face.
Right.
The kind of greenish.
Glowy.
The glowy one with the purple eyes is the evolved face. And the kind of skin one with his green eyes is his unevolved face. And I think they're trying to do something here, kind of. It's a little like the Outcast. Basically, Locke is not being a good Breen because he's wearing both faces. And it's clearly frowned upon in their culture to walk around with that other face.
And to fall in love with someone who isn't Breen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's very obvious, bad.
Uncool. But I think they are trying to make an inclusivity message here about how he's embracing this part of himself that society doesn't respect. His society doesn't respect.
Yeah, because he has no choices.
Right.
And so he had to leave to get choice.
Yeah, he feels trapped in that society and their, you know, morals.
Yes, and their shiny boots.
Now, there's like a tiny little nitpick I have, which is when he gets stabbed, it looks like he's bleeding some fluid, but there's some line in DS9 where they don't don't have blood. So, but I'm sure that could be explained. Like maybe that's his suit, some like coolant from his suit or something. So it's not really blood.
That's fine. Yeah, I know. I was like, because I looked them up. I was like, what do we know about the Breen? And I saw that. I was like, yeah, I didn't even know.
Yeah, they nailed a lot. I mean, the outfits and the sounds was very similar.
Yeah.
Obviously, if they had the same exact look from DS9, it would make sense because this is 8 centuries later, but it was all evolved well. The kind of shock staffs they have were similar to these weapons they had back in the day. So, no, I thought it was fascinating, and I could only assume we're going to learn more about the Breen, because they are now clearly the bad guys for the season.
Did we know about the blood bounty before and what it's called and all that?
No, that's all. So, right? All that's new stuff. So, you know, so there's a what she called the faction wars. So the what's now Breen Imperium, it used to be called the Confederation, I think, or Confederacy. You know, there's obviously some kind of either a civil war or a cold civil war. His uncle, you know, that, you know, he's part of one of the royal family that's trying to get control.
Right. One of the factions.
And we talked a bit about this last week about how Maul and Locke may be differently motivated, and you could tell Maul is, you know, kind of, I'm never giving up. Locke was like, okay, well, if we could be in the same prison, he's kind of open to the idea.
Right, because also then the Breen couldn't get them, so they'd be fine, and they could be together, which is the only thing he cares about. Yeah. She, unfortunately, has a bit of a Tarka from season 4 thing going on, where there's some place she's heard of and never been, and has her whole thing. It's her whole idea, like, because he was like, what do you need all the latinum for? And she wants to go there. And again, it's a repeat of a not great starting point.
Right. And it's some kind of magical place that, you know, Gamma Quadrant.
Yeah.
That her mom used to talk about because her dad went out for smokes and never came back or whatever, you know.
Her deadbeat dad, Cleveland Booker.
Yeah. She almost has a childlike view of the universe, I would say.
But it's like Tarka wanted to go to this place. It's like paradise. I've never been there. And then all these things to, I mean, he was a little more nutty in terms of trying to figure out how to get there. But her thing too is like, I want to go to this place that I've never been to.
Yeah, it's the thing that's apparently motivating both of them. Although for him, it's more like, if I can get this god tech and give it to the Breen, they will, you know, let me off the hook. Although Michael says they're just going to kill you anyway.
Right, which they are. She's right.
Probably, yeah. Because eventually, as you said, you know, that they'll probably have to join forces against the Breen.
That's right, yeah. Like, I think that's what's going to happen is they'll at some pivotal moment, they'll convince them, and that's when the Breen show up.
Yeah.
But that's good. Like, that'll be a good story. So I'm all in for that.
So we get to know them better. I think we get to know Book better. Why they start with him doing a log is to just let you know this is a Book episode. We're going to be exploring this character this episode. That's right. Why they do that kind of thing.
I mean, right. And this whole episode felt a lot like, oh, they're doing this because they're doing this because, like, I kept feeling it's a, I don't, when you start feeling the hand of the producers and writers more than you feel the characters doing things that are natural. Like another good example, like I liked the idea of putting Tilly and Culber together to have the kind of conversation that they had, but having her come into sick bay to help with comms and I need that was so like minor, but convoluted. And what you felt was, oh, we need her to see him, notice something about him and make a promise to talk. But it all feels manipulated and not natural to how things should.
I don't know. I thought that was fine. And I'm kind of glad that they just bookended the episode with that, where they didn't rerun that conversation. That. Yeah. Once we kind of got off the Discovery, we stayed off. And they kept the focus on the Enterprise. And then at the end, they kind of brought the Disco team back again.
Yeah, they went back a couple times, but it was because they were working on something. And they wanted to show Rayner in command and how that all went.
That was another good payoff where you could see the work from the last two episodes is paying off here. You know, and at the beginning, I liked how he's kind of reluctant to be in command because he still doesn't trust himself with this right. crew.
No, and he feels like you have a thing going and I'm not part of this thing yet. And then he proved that he could be. He also, one of my favorite exchanges in the whole thing was him saying, I don't need to know how the cake is boiled, Commander. And Adira says, Kelleran boil their cakes? And he says, don't knock it till you try it.
Yeah. They haven't really talked about him being a Kelleran at all. I think that's, we only knew that because, you know, his ears match and Michelle Paradise told us. But now this episode, there was the Kelleran cake and Kelleran ballad, the ballad yep. that, you know, so and he was talking about Kelleran booze. He's going to give them all.
Oh, the citrus mash.
So Memory Alpha Kelleran page gets a few additions this episode as well. Because that they're just a one episode DS9. DS9?
Yep. DS9 and not even they didn't even dig into them very much on DS9, which is my favorite kind of alien to bring back because it's open season. You can do whatever you want. Also, he does have this very fun habit of sniffing in response to things, which I like because I'm not sure if it's like an alien thing or a Rayner specific thing, but it's a fun little personal twitch that he just
little affectation. Sniffed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like all that stuff. I enjoyed.
I like how he goes in and the Stamets and I think it was Adira and or Tilly start techno babbling. And he just has zero time for that. And he's like, tell me in one sentence. And they try. And he realizes that he's like, okay, more words. You know?
Right. He goes, like, not that simple. I get it. Go on. And then he's like, okay, more words.
He's got them so on edge that they really think that they can't use more than one sentence. Like,
right.
Even though he and Stamets are the same rank, but he's the first officer and he yeah, used to that's be captain. Different.
Yeah. 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 And he's more used to, you know, being in charge of a bunch of people in general.
Yeah. But no, so it was a good episode for him. And we could see that they're going somewhere with Culber, where he's definitely, you know, the Jinal thing has shaken him up. And as I was saying, I think a couple episodes ago about this, they are going to explore this spirituality. You know, they made it explicit at the end yes. there, right?
Yeah, Tilly spells it out for him. Also, he's still doing such a great job, Wilson Cruz, because you know, we've seen him. He's been so confident. Like he walked into that Jinal thing, like, you know, emotionally overwhelming is my area of expertise. And he's all, you know, strong and sort of cocky. And even in this episode, his stance is different again. Like he's been changed. And he actually reminded me a little bit. Did you ever watch My So-Called Life?
No, I never did.
So it's only one season. I don't think it's a Tony show, but I loved it. And he was on it. And he was so young and so sweet and so vulnerable. And he reminded me of Ricky from My So-Called Life in certain moments. Like just just a little sweet and vulnerable and a little bit unsteady. And mm-hmm. so I thought his acting in this was great. I don't really feel clear on why he can't just talk to Paul about it.
Well, they tried to explain that Paul doesn't deal well with the uncertainty.
No, I know, but it's your husband. Like,
yeah, no, when, I get it.
You know, I would just say, like, that would make their conversation interesting. But I also just think, like, when it's your spouse and it's something that big that, you know, I would go to them. I might go to a friend first to hammer out how best to talk about it, maybe.
But that's exactly what happened because at the end, the impression I got was Tilly said, well, maybe you guys aren't that far apart. And
right. You should talk to them together.
Yeah. So this is just a guy talking to his friend about how do I deal with the, you know, that's the thing. Like, it was an appropriately timed, normal character conversation.
Exactly. It happened at the right time. The mission was done. They all had a moment. It was, I agree with that. And I liked it. I loved their dynamic. I like that he has someone he can talk to. And I just particularly appreciated his performance.
What did you think about they gave us a ticking clock. They had 60 seconds, so they're going to die. And, you know, Book is trying to, you know, make sure they get through the wormhole and they got a tractor beam and they've got to send a message to the Discovery. They don't know if the Discovery is going to figure it out. All of that was kind of cute if, you know, she used the tractor beam to send a little pulse. I mean, that was pretty risky that he'd figure out it was tied to Kelleran, but whatever. The point was, they're all going to die, and now she decides to have a conversation, a mini conversation. Michael,
but she does it because they could die.
Saying. That this wasn't a inappropriately timed sidebar. It was, we're going to die, so I do need to say something.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was, I have no issues with that at all. And their whole relationship as it's shifting and changing, I really enjoy watching. There's something about the two of them that just really draws me in. And you can see her slowly making her way. Like, even within the episode, I felt like he kept trying to, because they're on an adventure together, just the two of them. And he keeps trying to sort of draw her into their intimacy that they used to have. And it doesn't work at first. Like, she's resisting it. Although he gives her some saying and she's like, catchy, which is funny.
But that was funny.
That was funny. And then they moved towards each other and they had to come apart to do it, right? Like, they had to split up and do their thing. And then, speaking of the whole having to split up, now I'm jumping over. So we're in sick bay. It's a mirror universe ship. So it would have been very fun to have seen some scary things in sick bay that you would only see on the ISS Enterprise versus the
torture
USS.
Devices.
I didn't
see
any agony booths. I didn't see anything like that. And then I just thought that's what they should have done in sick bay was had it be some kind of weird mirror thing that trapped them or did whatever. Because
They glued a couple Terran Empire things to the wall. They painted the door goofy and they called it a day. Some of the stuff on the, the LCD panels was also more mirrory, but they could have gone a lot further. There was nothing mirror about that ship besides the trappings.
Like, you'd think the sick bay on an ISS Enterprise would be very small because they don't care. Right. You're sick. That's it. They don't care. So just more missed opportunity of, you know, it basically felt like, let's use this set because we have it from Strange New Worlds and everybody will be excited to see it and it already exists. And that, again, is what I'm saying about feeling the hand of the production reason versus the story reason.
That being said, that really didn't bother me so much. Besides the fact that we didn't get to see anyone like Mirror Spock, which would have been awesome. The one thing really was just a moment where you had that nice conversation with Michael and Book at the end.
Oh, I know where you're going.
And he says, hit it, referencing Captain Pike's. First of all, the fact that it was way too meta. How would he know this?
How would Book know that?
I mean, I mean, sure, Michael and him had plenty of time to talk about it. And she's like, oh, you know, I used to work with this guy and he used to say hit it. And this was his ship. But, you know, it's from another different universe. It was way too inside baseball. Makes no sense. So
I'm sorry, but I feel very mean girls whenever I say this because I want to say stop trying to make catchphrases a thing. They're not a thing.
But still, it's I know what you're saying about feeling the hands of the. That was the one, maybe not the one time, but the biggest time in the episode where I'm like, that's when I could see the you guys, you know, like stop doing that. And it takes you out of the episode.
And I felt the same way on Picard when they did it. Exactly the same way. Yeah, like, what are you doing? Stop it.
I think you had more of those issues than I did because I was really getting into all the lore dumps and that kind of stuff. And I really did. You know, I thought David Ajala did a really good performance in this episode. As did Elias and Eve Harlow.
Yeah, the performances were terrific.
Yeah.
Across the board. Everybody. Every single person was great.
Yeah. Callum Keith Rennie, you know, he's just continues to be doing a great job. Something that just – we just don't know why. We could only assume it's for logistics is – so, you know, they keep on talking about OO and Detmer.
Oh, yeah.
But we never see them. And I think they just want them to be part of the show. But I'm guessing the actresses
– we're busy.
We're busy. So that's why they have new actresses and these new characters who are getting lines and we're learning little bits about them. Not much, but, you know, they're part of the team. You know, Rainer, you know, he's trying to have everyone throw ideas. Because if you think about the last episode where he was shutting people down, this time he's like, you know, so he's growing as a character. And that was great.
And he still did it in his own style, which I liked. Yeah. He's not trying to emulate Michael's style, which he can't do. And in fact, I would have turned down some of her touchy-feely stuff. Like, I felt like she had some, her dialogue was fine, but it was just a little too, it almost sounded condescending when she was telling them they were doing a good job. Because it was so like, great work versus the way. But I thought like he was still his gruff self, but he's like, come on, people. And he's offering them motivation. I don't know how much citrus mash is going to be.
Let's say it's really rare and expensive.
It's really good, that citrus mash. But he was very much in character. That's the reason I'm enjoying him so much is that he is this like gruff, stubborn guy who learns.
I do have another nitpick here. This is super nerdy.
Is it about
The solution to the problem was to change the photon torpedoes to replace their payloads with antimatter, and photon torpedoes are antimatter torpedoes. That's the whole point of a photon torpedo. Now, I'm sure this could my headcanon is they were like adding more antimatter or whatever, but that didn't make any sense. And if this was going to, because they kept on throwing all this technobabble at him, and they're like, and this is the best technobabble. I'm like, well, if you've picked this as your best technobabble, it should make sense. And it didn't.
Right.
I think the bigger thing here, getting back to OO and Detmer, which we think is logistic, is obviously the same must be true of Doug Jones. This can't be a creative choice. He wasn't in the episode. That's two in a row.
He's not in the credits.
Three episodes ago, I was like, oh, my God, I'm worried that we're going to get like, you know, boring scenes of him at, you know, working out
napkins.
Yeah. Now I'm like, what color napkins did they pick out? I mean, I want to know now because I'm missing Doug so much. I'm sure there's a good reason.
That's why I wish Mirror Saru had left some sort of log. Would have been nice.
Again, they would have done that if he was available. I mean, that's the thing. They want Saru and OO and Detmer to all be part of the story, even though the actors aren't around. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. We're missing Doug more than anyone. We know he's going to be back later in the season. We know he's part of the finale and part of the coda. So this just has to be a thing where he was probably shooting something else or whatever.
Yeah. And it's not like you can just pop in and do a quick Saru scene because they need hours before and hours afterwards.
Yeah, it's not an afternoon.
Get him suited up. So he can't just say, I have 3 hours free. I'll come by and do something because that's not going to work. But the other two, I mean, it was so funny because, we're going to give the Enterprise to Detmer and Washington. And so they give it to them. And Rainer's like, they deserve it. And I'm thinking, I don't think you've met them.
Yeah. That's true. Has he? No. Were they in the give me 20 words? No, they weren't in that episode.
No, I don't think they were.
They were talked about. So that's a thing.
Yeah.
They keep on talking about them in episodes so that we think they were in them, but they weren't.
Which is smart.
They were in last week's episode.
It's a good way to do it is to say, they're off doing something. You know, it's good. Yeah, they were in last week's, but he hasn't spent any real time with them. Anyway, maybe they all had a drink at Red's.
where we learned a very important thing. Linus can play piano.
Yes, I was thinking that maybe we need a Linus ability watch because we know he can lay three clutches of eggs or whatever, right? And we know he can play the piano.
You know, now that I think about it, have we ever got a good look at his hands? Like, how many fingers does Linus have?
I don't know, but he's a lovely piano player. That was funny. That was fun.
Yeah, there's plenty of things in this where you go, God, that's you know, weird. But in general, I still liked the episode, especially because it's, you know, it is a... See, now we'll never want to use the word filler again because it's now become this thing. But I feel like this is a good character episode, a decent bottle episode. I do agree with you that they overdid it on some stuff to kind of, you know, and yet didn't do it enough. Like they didn't redress the Enterprise enough, perhaps.
Right. To make it worth it. Like it didn't really have to be the Enterprise.
Well, it's what they had, right?
They had to build some new sets. It's what they had.
They go on location or they do another virtual story-wise, set. Story-wise,
it didn't have to be. Right. Production-wise, I understand.
Because they were using all the Breen scenes were done on the volume. So they created a kind of virtual set for the Breen. It was like a ship or a space station or something. Yeah. They work with what they have, I guess.
Sure. But I mean, that's because I could feel that was why. So that kind of sucked. And and the action scenes I found very hard to follow or get excited about. And I also, you know, sometimes they fall back into old habits. And one of the old habits that I don't love is I feel like they make the point and then they add some more dialogue to really make sure, like, what was it when Michael says to Raina, like, I believe in you or something. And I was like, you didn't, she's showing him she believes in him. She doesn't need to tell him. And it's just small things. And it's just sort of the discovery way that I felt like they've been doing a very nice job of toning that stuff down. And then this episode, that's, I would say across the board, felt weaker to me because of the accumulation of those things. Even though the character stuff was great.
Yeah.
And the backstory stuff was very intriguing and well done.
Now, I mean, this isn't a nitpick as much as something worries me about how they're treating the map on the ship. The little, you know, because think about how valuable that thing is, it's right? Just they've got, there. And they kind of just leave it sitting around because you almost feel like inevitably there's going to be an episode where Maul and Locke board the ship and try to steal it. I mean, that's, you know, which is because, you know, the bad guys are always boarding our ships. Like,
yes.
Don't they have like a place where they could lock that thing up or something? Because Michael just like leaves it around like, oh, you know, and it used to be sitting around in the lab. It feels like this is the most valuable thing in the universe right now, technically. And they should put a couple armed guards on it. You know, they just like at the end, they leave it in the room, then just leave. It's just sitting there. They don't know where Maul and Locke are. They disappeared in a warp pod. I feel like that's going to come and bite them on the ass later on.
Yeah, well, they're certainly being very lazy about it. I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
You always have answers, which I appreciate. In sickbay, was it sickbay? There were all the things for kids, like a stuffed animal. And
that wasn't in sickbay. So,
oh, that was somewhere else. But why? What was the point of that?
Well, see, that's the thing. Like in that scene, they were telling you, not showing you, the transporter room is where there was a trace of the clue. For whatever reason, the transporter room was where the refugees, because they called them refugees, right? So eventually Saru got the ship and used it to escape to the Prime Universe, and it was full of people who wanted to leave the Mirror Universe.
Oh, randos, not just the crew.
He referred to refugees. So I guess at... once they were done gathering the refugees, the ship was, and particularly the transporter room was just full of, of kids and families who
lockets,
you know,
and stuffed animals.
Right. And eventually they left when they ended up in the pocket dimension and escaped into the Prime dimension, Prime Universe.
Right. I think I just missed the word refugees, and I just thought that it was the crew. All right. Well, thank you. See, I knew you'd have the answer.
And we saw this in Discovery, in fact, that there were just some regular folk in the Terran Empire. They weren't evil. They don't all have goatees. Some people were just trying to get by. And when things got even worse, they left, you know, thanks to season 3 Georgiou, right? Because Georgiou, via Carl, went back and made some changes, kind of. And she saved Saru, right? So,
right, yes, she saved Saru.
And that led to this, essentially. Yep. So Georgiou's part of the season, too. Everyone gets to help out in their own little way.
Nice. That's so loving.
She didn't get name dropped.
No, but you know who did get name dropped? The Gormagander.
Right.
I thought that was nice. I like a little Gormagander reference.
And a Cardassian vole got name dropped. So there's a little.
And someone has one. Someone's got a tribble. Someone's got a vole. These things nobody wants.
Tribble's got name dropped. Maul name dropped. She was joking about bringing a tribble onto the Breen ship.
Right. Because they can't resist the tribbles.
Osira got name dropped, but I really hope that they're just going to leave it there.
Please stop. Please don't scare us with that. I mean, I think that's it. To me, it was definitely the weakest one of the season for me. For the reason I already said. Yeah, because I kept getting snapped out of it. Because those distractions were, for me, big. Like, not understanding what's going on and where people are in relation to each other makes it, all of a sudden, I'm a little bored because I haven't latched on to it.
Right.
So, and then just feeling those intrusive hands coming in, being like, well, oh, they're doing this because of that. So I was happy with the development that we got, but overall, just didn't enjoy watching it as much.
I get it, but I did. I wouldn't call it the worst of the season, not the best of the season. And I'm still enjoying the season.
Me too.
We're halfway through it. It's hard to believe that. In theory, they're going to have the whole map together by, if they find it, you know, I guess the thing they showed us many times is a vial of something at the end, purple liquid.
And
that's the next clue to the next thingy.
Yep. They got to figure out the vial and they have the map. So,
but there's also this kind of interesting thing, which they pointed out, which is each clue is a lesson. And this gets into the Janal episode of, you know, well, if you trust us, why don't you just tell us where the damn thing is? You know, but you've got to go through the journey. You've got to learn your lessons. So all of these lessons they're learning, et cetera, are going to be important. Even if you have the map, you need to be worthy to get to the final thing, whatever that is.
Like Michael having to give the clue on Trill goes back to the fact that she knew what happened with the missing verse and the fake verse and the decoy. And she's already using what she's learned as she moves forward. So that'll keep happening. I mean, they had to say it all, of course.
Yeah, of course.
Just like they had to keep saying, you have a choice. You always have choices. There's a choice. Here's my choice. Michael made a choice about Book.
Another person they could have, you know, we're extending our goodbye here, but maybe the most important character in this episode that wasn't in this episode was Cleveland Book, the original.
Right.
It's like, you know what? Maybe a flashback to him would have helped things move along as well. We've never met this guy, right? But I guess we're probably going to, I mean, maybe we will get a flashback to Maul's childhood with Book and the original Cleveland Booker.
Well, it's not the original, right? Because weren't there a whole bunch of them?
Well,
each one takes the name of, right.
Right. Yeah. It's like the Dread Pirate Roberts. But the, there's a deep cut for you.
But less swashbuckling. Oh, maybe not less swashbuckling.
But nonetheless, he's a very important character. Maul's father was a very important character that I kind of feel like we need to meet this guy at some point.
Yeah. And find out why he didn't come back.
Yeah. He's typical deadbeat dad, right?
Yeah.
But they tried to explain that. He's like, because his lifestyle was going to put them in danger. But, you know, Mom ended up in a horrible
mind. Then maybe have a different lifestyle. What you're doing puts your family in danger.
Yeah.
Then maybe you should come back and be with your family.
Another job, especially because, well, I guess, you know, this is the Burn era. There weren't a lot of choices.
Back to choices.
Again. Okay. Well, that's enough of that.
Theme alert. I did like the moment when she had both of the phasers, or the both of the weapons, and she was pointing them like Jack Bauer. Like, no, I've got two. She had, like, he hands her his and she's pointing them. And I just had a Jack Bauer flashback because he always would grab two.
But I did like the fact that she is relentless, you know, like every, you know, she had many choices, many chances in the episode, but she's sticking with her thing. It's just, she's not easy to crack.
Well, she's been through some shit, which I get. Like, we know that she is a prisoner of the Emerald Chain. We know her mother had this horrible death. So we know that, and they were beating the crap out of her, those Breen.
Yeah.
And that moment when they give him the weapon and he's supposed to kill her, and she looks at him and says her little comment, but it's like she's basically saying, I get it. You're doing what you have to do. Like, that's, you know, she loved him.
There's something heartwarming about their love. You know, both of them love each other very much.
And that's what Cleveland got very early on, just from watching their ship do stuff. He was able to, he figured out they're in love and they're living on the edge. And Michael is getting that too. I think we would have benefited from a more interesting conversation with Michael and Locke than the fighty-fighty. Like, oh, the glass broke. It's so dramatic. But I think they could have had a better, longer conversation.
Yeah, that probably would have helped.
But I did like that moment when they're both sitting down and she's like, yeah, it's exhausting. Like, they've obviously been standing and they kind of gave it up. So that's almost a moment I would have liked to have seen in a way, but it worked. No, you know, it worked. I liked it.
I think we're done with the episode, right? Yes. Yeah. Anything else? Nope.
Nope.
We're done.
All right. Well, now it's time for our bits of the week. Tony, you should go first.
Firstly, we haven't done a business update in a while. There was some big news last week, which we haven't put up on the site and talking, that is that Sony has joined the Apollo bid. So they are now in the mix to buy Paramount. So I want to recommend a podcast I like to listen to for those of you who like the talk about the weeds of business. So this isn't a Star Trek thing. This is a Hollywood thing. And it's a podcast from The Ringer called The Town. And the people who do this are from something called Puck, which is this great industry, both Hollywood and politics newsletter. This latest episode is titled Which Bidder is Best for Paramount? And it goes over the Sony bid and the Skydance bid and gets really into the weeds. And they have a finance guy and kind of a Hollywood guy debating over which one is better. Really, the fundamental question facing Paramount now, and this is going to have a big impact on Star Trek, is do they go with Skydance, who want to keep the studio together, but it's not a short-term win for shareholders, except for Sherry Redstone. but they have this plan and they want to use AI and, you know, it's complicated. Or do they go for the Apollo Sony Legendary bid, which would essentially turn Paramount into a brand of Sony? Paramount Plus would almost certainly be merged or sold off or something like that. But it'd be a short-term win for shareholders because it would be an immediate guaranteed payout of a premium. You know, I think that Sherry's going for the Skydance deal, but listen to the podcast, get into the weeds, and that's all I got to say about it. Which is already too much.
It's a lot, but it's okay. There are a lot of people interested. People are always asking what you think of all that stuff, and I have very little to contribute, so it's good when you do it. Mine this week is also a podcast. It's The Seventh Rule, which I enjoy, but a particular episode, they got Michael Westmore on, who is always such a great speaker and storyteller, and he's a makeup legend. And he was talking about the Next Generation episode, Allegiance, which is one that I have always personally loved. It's one of my little quirky, weird personal favorites. You might even say it's sort of a filler episode in its own way.
Remind people what's going on in Allegiance.
Picard is kidnapped and finds himself like in this weird sort of lab with several other aliens trying to figure out why are they trapped in this room and there's no one talking to them. They're by themselves. It's just that one of them's our first female Bolian. And then at the same time, there's a fake Picard singing on the Enterprise. Right. He sings a big drinking, a rousing drinking song. But the makeup for the different aliens, we had a bunch of one-off aliens in that episode. So Michael Westmore talked about making each of the aliens and the decisions they made. And also, I think, you know, it's one of my favorite things he talked about was basically the script would just say, whatever script came in for Star Trek would just say an alien. And it was up to him to just decide. It's not like they said, oh, and this one has a bony head and can only breathe through a tube. Nope, that was all just Michael Westmore having to come up with this stuff. So it's a great listen. I thought Sarah Loughton and Ryan Husk asked really good questions and had a great conversation. Although I wanted to say to both of them, go read his book, because they were surprised by him telling them about how he used to do a fake nose for Michael Jackson so Michael Jackson could go just walk around town. And stories like that are in his book, and his book is phenomenal.
The guys behind the Star Trek documentaries like the DS9 doc and the upcoming Voyager doc have announced they're going to do a whole documentary just on Michael Westmore.
Oh, they've already started interviews because Terry Farrell has already done stuff for them.
And it's going to be beyond his Star Trek stuff because, as you said, there's much more to his life than that.
Rocky, Raging Bull, like his resume is unbelievable. He's worked with everybody. He has the best stories. If anyone is worthy of a documentary, he's the guy.
For sure.
Before we go, I would like to tell everybody I'm going on vacation. So I will not be doing the news for the next 2 weeks. We have already recorded one of the two reviews that's going to happen. And if the next episode comes in before I go, then we'll do it. And otherwise, Tony will have to find somebody else.
I'm sure I could wrestle someone, but there's no one that can replace you, but there may be someone who's
going to replace me.
Can sit in.
This is the longest vacation I can remember going on as an adult. So it should be fun.
Well, I'm excited for you.
Thank you.
And for Little Riker.
Oh, yes. Little Riker's never been to France. So he's very excited. And then he'll, you know, go to Vegas and meet Big Riker. So exciting times ahead. So have a great couple of weeks, although you'll still hear my voice.
That's true.
And that's it.
Goodbye.